Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 5th, 2019. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
So, you did your whirlwind thing. I gotta ask you, was it hot in Las Vegas?
I don't know. I was barely outside. 46 hours I was there. It was. I can tell you it was cold in the Aria. I had my hoodie on while I was in there. And actually, it wasn't hot at night. I was at hanging out on Fremont Street for a couple hours. That was really the only time I was outside the entire 46 hours.
Because it's just ridiculous how hot it is everywhere. I mean, Europe is going through like 20 straight days of 100 plus or some crap like that. And then it's just brutal here in Florida. And then I remember just how hot it is in Vegas, but it's like always like, oh, it's like a dry heat. And I'm like, what does that mean? You'll still die from too much heat. So I was just curious if they were going through the same thing we are, if it was just their normal temperatures.
Yeah, it seemed fairly normal to me, I think. I think when we landed, it was like in the 90s at night. But
oh, man.
Dry heat.
Dry heat. Brutal.
All right, as Chris mentioned, I did the... very quickly fly out to Vegas for the Poker TDA Summit this year, which they do every 2 years. And I'm going to go through the big stuff that they decided this year. But overall, I was talking to some other folks there, and I thought it was interesting that there wasn't any big fights this year. There weren't any big real decision points. And I think the reason for that is that this is the ninth summit, so they've been doing this for almost 20 years, if not 20 years. And I think they've kind of figured out all the big stuff now, Chris.
I was going to say, are you trying to tell me that they have honed in on now, like, the perfect rules and that there's never going to be any? I mean, no, come on. Something's always going to come up.
Well, no. Hey, trust me. I've got a whole list of stuff here, as you can tell. Show notes. But none of it's drastically big. I mean, there's a couple things that are interesting. That are probably going to be talked about. But for the most part, I mean, they're just and even like 2 years ago at the summit, the big discussion then was the big blind ante, which was something that was created back then, right?
Yeah.
It didn't exist. So, yeah. And that was the big the beginning of this summit as well, too. So, you know, it's really just refining a little bit. So I guess kudos. It only takes 20 years to get it down to where you're really just arguing over fine hairs going forward. So. As I mentioned, the big blind ante was the big discussion last year. This year, they did approve adding it as a recommended procedure. It seemed like almost everybody is doing it now. Most everybody's doing it as the big blind. A couple of people were doing it on the button, but they obviously they're switching to big blind now. And also, they approved not reducing it at the final table. Some rooms were doing that when it was getting kind of shorthanded. They would go down to the small blind amount rather than the big blind amount. But there's a little arm twisting to get everybody on board with not reducing it. So,
but you can see why they want to reduce it. You know, I mean, it makes sense. Fewer players are still paying the same amount as if it was a full table.
Yeah, and I think one of the overall themes from the board, and I completely agree with them, is that we should be encouraging action in tournaments. We should not be encouraging long tournaments. We should encourage aggression.
Yeah.
And when you have the bigger ante there, there's more to play for, and it drives the action. It makes the game more exciting. Now, if you are a rock, a very passive player, you're not going to like any of that. But as an operator, you know, they want big action games. I think most players want big action games. But certainly from an operator standpoint, you want people betting and raising and getting it in and getting out and getting in their cash game. So
does my heart good to hear you use rock correctly. It only took 16 years for you to know what a rock is in poker. It's fantastic.
See, I'm just arguing over fine hairs now, too. However, there was no immediate consensus on a recommended procedure for players paying the ante before the big blind ante, since the World Series of Poker and PokerStars still prefer the latter. But there was good discussion on why that is wrong, in quotes, because it's your opinion, but I am firmly on the ante-first train now, and I think most people at the end of the summit were as well, too. It was interesting at the beginning. They took a show of hands, and I don't want to say it was 50-50. It was probably 60-40 before the big blind. On the last day when they went through this, they were all just a stragglers, like maybe 10 that were still in favor of the big blind paying his big blind first before the ante. So, and I credit that to the very good discussion we had. And some of those things were Johnny Grooms from MGM National Harbor actually said, remember what ante means. It means first. That's the word. And then the argument that most people had is that if you are short stacked at the big blind and you don't have enough to cover both and you put just the ante in, all you can win back is what you put into the pot. And that does seem frustrating, but something I hadn't thought of, but they really hammered home there, was that that is one hand in the whole loop around the table. All the other loops around the table, you have a chance to get way more for that ante than you should have, because you're picking up blinds. If you're tearing on the button and you move in for what the big blind ante would be, you actually qualify for the blinds now. So eight of your nine hands at the table, the big ante before the big blind is a benefit to you. It's only that one time that it happens in the big blind.
Right.
So that seemed to sell everybody on it. So what they're going to do is they're going to have a conversation with the World Series Poker. Obviously, they're in the middle of the World Series Poker, so they're not going to change it now. But after they're done, and see whether they can get them on board with it. And if they get them on board with it, then hopefully PokerStars, which does a lot of live events in Europe, will get on board with it. And then 2 years from now, we'll be able to make that a recommended procedure. But if you're in a room and they are doing the big blind first, I mean, really think about it. Because the ante really, really makes more sense, I think. So,
yeah.
Final tables will now be 9-handed instead of 10. Quite honestly, I never understood why they did that anyhow. I mean, you play 9-handed the entire tournament, and then the final table becomes 10. So they finally decided to change that and make it 9-handed now. Yeah. They also eliminated the 2-motion raise. I love this, too. So, you know, what that means is when you announce raise, but you put in the call, and then you put in the raise, can't do that anymore. So, if you say raise, the next motion you put is the amount that you want to raise in the pot. Obviously, you can still announce how much it is and take your time getting it there, but we all know, as we talk about on call floor every week on this show, people, for whatever reason, don't like to talk at the table. So,
but what happens? Like, what are you trying to say there? Like, so in other words, if I say raise and I put in the call first, now I can only raise a minimum?
Min raise, yeah.
Okay, exactly. All right, okay. Because you have to still raise, because verbal's
going to raise. Okay. She said raise, but yeah, you'll be forced to a minimum raise.
Okay, there you go, good.
Yeah. this is probably going to be the most controversial thing to come out of this. Dealers should now announce all action at the table, including bet and raise amounts, except for all in bets. So, you know, before, dealers were kind of taught this to be quiet and, you know, obviously lead the action. But if somebody puts in a bet or a raise, not to say how much that bet or raise is. So this is a pretty big fundamental change this year.
Yeah.
And they did do it at the they tested it out at the TDA tournament on Friday night. I was so wiped from my red eye flight that I couldn't make it, but it was a great time. And they did in the Poker Go studios at Aria, too. So. Everybody said it was fantastic, but they had all the dealers do it there so the TDA members could see it in action. And it seemed like, from everybody talking the following day, that they liked it. So I really am a fan of this, I think. I think it's good that, you know, we want dealers to be more active. You know, I didn't speak there, but, you know, if somebody would ask me, what I would have said is that, you know, one of the biggest problems we have with our call to floors, or what players have, is that they kind of want the dealers to be a little bit more active in the game. You know, they're fine accepting personal responsibility for what they need to do, but it would be nice if the dealer was helping out a little bit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So this should actually help with action. It should make things clear. Some haters are already on Twitter about it, that it's going to slow down the game, but that's only if you shove in weird size chip stacks or make weird size bets that take a while to count down. But otherwise, it should help make the action much more clear and hopefully eliminate people saying, oh, I didn't know it was that much, or I didn't know what the action was. Now the dealer's really becoming a much more active part of the game. So I'm a fan of it. We'll see how it plays out,
though. Looks like dealers are going to want more money, though. I mean, seriously, it's a lot more responsibility on their part now, and they're a lot more, and it's more work. I mean, I know they realize they pay attention to everything, and they have to add up stuff.
One of the arguments was that the good thing is keeping dealers more involved in the game. So, so the dealers are probably going to be whining about it at the beginning. They might continue to whine about it going forward, but it keeps their head in the game, and their head is supposed to be in the game. Oops, I got the...
Holy cow! Late-breaking business for any up.
But, you know, the dealer should be active in the hand, but, you know, now when all they have to do is just collect the bets at each round and then put them in, it's a little, it's a lot easier just to kind of zone out, right?
Zone out, yeah.
So you will not be able to zone out with this now. You're going to be actively following what's going on. So, in theory, that part should probably speed up the game, even though they will have to, you know, cut down chips, depending on the size of the bets and the amount put in. But again, that's pretty rare, right? So,
right.
You know, one of the things they kept talking about is if you're running a tournament, no player should have more than a rack of chips in front of them. There's no stage of a tournament that any player needs more than a rack of chips. If you have more than a rack of chips, that means you haven't colored up well. And so if you keep that to a rack of chips, then, you know, you're not going to have these huge stacks that need to be cut down and counted. So kind of goes back to the whole operators operating correctly as well, too. So
unless it's the World Series of Poker, I mean, then those guys have way more than a rack of chips in front of them at the main event.
Well,
at the
it's
end.
All about coloring up, too. So,
yeah.
You know, even if you have 35 million units in front of you, you could still do that on a rack of chips. So, and that's kind of what they were trying to get at. So, and then also with the big blind Andy now, one of the other advantages is the small chips are off the table.
Right,
you know,
right.
You're not starting with quarter chips anymore because you don't need them. So that certainly helps as well. So lots of benefits to Big Blind Andy that go beyond that. So
cool.
You're going to love this, Chris. They didn't come up with a specific recommended procedure, but they did suggest that random card theory may be used to address any issues. And this was kind of a offshoot of the next thing we're going to talk about in Stud. There was a lot of discussion about whether you are, as a player, entitled to the card that was destined for you.
Yay!
Having this discussion again, right?
Yep.
Or are you entitled to simply a random card? And I think most folks there agree that you are entitled to a random card, not the card that necessarily was due for the flop or the turn of the river or to your hand. The card that you're being given, even if there's a mistake, is still random. And therefore, that's what you're entitled to. So, but it was interesting. We had a lot of foreign tournament directors there this year, a lot from Asia. And one of them stood up and he's like, I really think you guys need to come up with a definition for random card theory because I just Googled it and it doesn't exist. And the funny thing is, I was doing it as well and I couldn't find it either. So they are going to come up with a definition of that right now, kind of early, to really talk about all the situations where they want to, but the thought process is getting to the point that, you know, if there's a mistake at some point, you just take the card that was prematurely exposed and then shuffle it into the deck right away and make it right at that point, you know, whereas the longstanding procedure is if, you know, you have a premature turn card, right, you know, that becomes the burn card, and then you put the correct, in quotes, river card out as a turn, and then you shuffle in and allow that turn card to come back out. So what they're suggesting now is you could not do that procedure. You immediately take that exposed card, put it in the shuffle, and put out a turn in the river. So the destined river card will not automatically come out. Obviously, it has a chance to come back out. But then again, no one's ever seen it, so... You know, why does it matter?
Well, the weird thing, too, is that the word may is there. So, I mean, I think there have been rooms that have done this anyway. So it's like, and right? I mean, I think people have done it. It's weird.
I think what they ended up deciding on that point is that they weren't ready to really write language for it. They wanted to see how it played out. A lot of the stuff they do here is they suggest people go back and test it out and then come back in 2 years and talk about it. So they kind of wanted to test it out a little bit and see. But it also gives rooms freedom within the language there to do that rather than other things. So I think what it ended up being is, as I said here, when there's no specific recommended procedure in the TDA, then they to remedy that situation, now you can use random card theory. So they weren't willing. There are a lot of TDA members that weren't willing to throw out all the recommended procedures that are in there now and just replace it with random card theory. So you know, those specific things that were in there before remain, but now there's this freedom to do random card theory. And it also allows rooms to do that in place of the recommended procedure that's in there as well too. So if you're a card manager and you're like, hey, we're going to be a random card theory room, go for it and see how it works out. I mentioned big changes in stud. These are actually very significant changes, but as Matt Savage joked, big changes in a dying game. No more double bets with pairs on the board on 4th Street, Chris.
Wow, that's crazy.
Right?
Yeah, we've been doing that their whole lives. And one thing I want to say is this is still just poker TDA. It's not cash.
It's not cash games. Yeah. But as they mentioned, they're hoping that as players see this done in tournaments, that it'll migrate to cash games, which it usually does. So it was an interesting, from a historical perspective, to listen to the discussion, is that they're like, you know, hey, no one really knows why that bet is doubled on 4th Street. No one could really trace it back to figure out why it was. And as we know from Stud 8, it's not doubled in Stud 8, right?
Right.
So, so they asked Barry Greenstein, who was one of the biggest fans of Stud out there, and he's like, I can't figure it out either, so just get rid of it. So it was essentially a rule, Barry Greenstein approved rule, getting rid of it.
Wow.
And it was somebody else said, you know, this is the only situation in a fixed limit game where it's not fixed limit. When you think about that, and they did say, well, in a kill game it's different, but that's before the hand starts. But this is the only time in the middle of the hand that the fixed limit can change.
So. Oh, well, that's not true, because the next thing you're going to say is also the all in at the end if your card's exposed. That's not fixed either.
Yeah, but that's actually not changing the bet. That's just cutting off the betting
point. But you can declare yourself all in. That's changing the amount you can bet.
Not the same thing. But as Chris mentioned, the other big change is if you're dealt a card face up on 7th Street, you no longer have the option of declaring yourself all in for the hand. Instead, that exposed card is going to be shuffled back in the deck, and you'll be dealt a new down card. So
Makes sense.
The way it has been, you know, if the dealer accidentally deals your up card up, on 7th Street, which completely messes up the whole 7 card the beauty of 7 cards, right? That your hand, the true strength of your hand is always hidden.
Yeah.
The rule was before, you could, at that point, you were forced to take the card, but you could announce that you are not putting any more money into the pot, and action would stop that way, so you can't be harmed by it, right? So, but now they're going to take that card, shuffle back in, and give you a down card, so you can actually play poker.
Makes sense.
I think that's fantastic.
It's just absolute common sense. Let me ask you something. Didn't we used to just deal everyone's card face up then?
Yeah, but again, you think about that, though. I mean, now you've already bastardized one hand. Now you're bastardizing everybody's hand. And again, that's the beauty of stud, is that, you know, you have three down cards, so you know you never know the true strength of your hand. So now you're forcing everybody to do that, then it really messes things up. So feel bad for the dealer that does this, because you know it's going to happen. But if they deal an up card to somebody on 7th Street, stop, shuffle it back in the deck, peel it out, and then make the same mistake to the next person, they're going to take that card back and shuffle it again. So
well, if they do that, then they shouldn't be dealing. So
I think the one thing they also talked about is how many times dealers put out a flop in a stud game like that. So that this would all be remedied that same way. You would pick all those cards up, shuffle back in, and so they all have a chance to come back out. But could take a little bit more time, but again, that's goes back to what you said is, you know, dealer skill. So, you know, don't make the mistake and you don't have to reshuffle.
Right, exactly.
Let's see, there was discussion on, but no agreement on whether players should be required to keep chips in stacks of 20. You know, there's been a big push the last couple of summits to really get players to keep their chips identifiable. You know, part of the thing is your opponent should be able to see and count your chips. You know, sometimes that's not easy to do, but you're supposed to be making them countable. And so instead of like a big mosh pit of chips in front of you, right? So they want to go a little bit farther this time, or some people, I should say, want to go a little bit farther this time and require that you keep your chips and stacks of 20 if you have them. So it's a much more easy to count. But they ultimately decided that they didn't want to require that. They wanted some individuality left in the game. So, you know, if you want to do something a little bit different than chip counts, chip stacks, you should be free to do that, but they have to be easily identifiable. So I think the ending standard was, you know, if a tournament director looks at your stack and can't figure out how many chips you have, then it's probably not in a good order. So
yeah, I mean, it slows down the game.
Yeah. So it doesn't have to be 20. It could be 10s. It could be 30s. It could be 40s. But, you know, a good tournament director should be able to count your chips without actually touching them. And if you make it too difficult for them to do it, then you'll be asked to clean them up a little bit. Mm. But you have options, though, and we'll see how you want to clean it up. So this is another kind of big change, too. Missed deals can now be called even after substantial action has taken place when it's determined that the hand has been played with a fouled deck. And so there was some discussion on what constitutes a fouled deck. Some states... gaming commissions actually define what a foul deck is, so it's kind of difficult for the TDA to define that when there are multiple definitions around. But they did just say foul deck, and that's up to the rooms and to decide what constitutes a foul deck. But you know, it used to be, you know, once you have a substantial action, that hand plays out, and you know, the winner gets the chips, and then they fix the deck going forward. But so the change here, though, is if they, you know, find out that somebody didn't turn their cards in after the last hand, and even you've got a bet, raise, all-ins, all that kind of stuff, you give all those bets back and start to hand over with the proper deck.
Oh, man. Can't wait for those hands of the week to come. I mean, hands of the calls of fours to come in.
Exactly. But yeah, that was another interesting discussion. I mean, we're trying to make these everything as fair as possible, right? You know, we keep saying you don't want to win on a technicality. In a hand, I mean, this is the same way. You are, you know, if the deck wasn't complete, then, you know, everybody should have a fair chance of winning that pot.
Yeah,
and if it wasn't, then you got to do the old, you know, growing up after school do-over on the kickball field, right?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it is. So, but, you know, hopefully you don't have it at many where it's actually a foul deck. I mean, there are other issues where, you know, action would continue, but we're talking about foul decks. So, and then a couple more discussions about player responsibilities. They had a brief but a pretty interesting discussion on clothing. They actually showed a picture of a guy wearing a motorcycle helmet at the table. Can you imagine that? And then, of course, you know, lots of people are covering their faces with scarves and hoods and glasses and everything, so you can't get any reads on them. So they had a discussion about whether you're entitled to be able to get those reads. Didn't get anywhere on that, but essentially they said you have to be identifiable to the cameras. So if your identity is so concealed that the cameras can't tell who you are, you're going to have to make yourself identifiable. Now, that being said, once you're in a hand, you are more than welcome to cover up as much as you want to, you know, keep your opponents from getting a read on you. So some people wanted to go a little bit farther and prevent that, but they decided to stop it just at making sure you're identifiable in the room.
Yeah, when I first read this last night, because you updated the file, and I was checking the night before, and I first read it, I thought it said, but you can still hide your face with your hand. I'm like, okay, you put your hand over your face, but that's all you're allowed to do.
Jules got small hands, buddy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you could probably do that. and then the last one, and my favorite one, a line is going to be added to the player etiquette rule about proper hygiene.
So, wow.
If you're smelly and the tournament director says you're smelly and you can't be unsmelly, you could be asked to leave.
Wow.
Or not be seated. And there were some tournament directors that say, hey, after a player came in, they played, and then they busted out, and they went to re-enter. And I told them, you can re-enter if you go home and shower.
Wow.
And I'm like, that's a room I want to play in. So
that's fantastic.
Just take care of yourself. You know, you want to be sure that you're not making other people uncomfortable, like the guy wearing shorts and hairy legs that was in half of my seat on my flight home. Bad enough flying Frontier and a red eye, but
I could just see the poker rooms now, though. I mean, they're like, hey, you can't play in this tournament. The guy would be like, fine, I'll go play in cash games and stink up the place over there.
And they'll probably be walked out of the room there, too. So that's what it was this year. I mean, obviously, they after every year or summit, they go back through and they massage the language and then send it out later. So all the official stuff will come out in the next month or so. But that was the big stuff from this year.
All right, cool.
All right, before the first 50 honor ceremony of this year's World Series of Poker, the WSOP released a list of the 50 greatest players in history as voted on by a player and media, not us, panel.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of names on here are exactly what you thought. There are a couple younger players that I think might be a little bit of a stretch for the 50 greatest poker players in history.
I felt the same way. I felt like it was an awful young list.
Yeah, but I'm like Fedor Holz. I mean, he's a phenomenal player, absolutely phenomenal, but he's like 12, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, some of these players, I mean, we've seen it over the years, too. There's players that have a hot streak, and then they just disappear. You never hear from them ever again. So so that'll be my only nitpick on this list. But you got some big names on here that certainly make sense. You know, Stu Unger, of course, is on there. Barry Greenstein, Phil Hellmuth. But definitely some young guns. Tom Dwan made the list.
Yeah.
He's 14 years old, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. It just seems like a very modern list with some nods to, you know, legends in the past. But, I mean, it just seemed very modern. I would wonder if, you know, if you just sat down with, say, Doyle or, you know, somebody like that and say, hey, you know, what do you think of this list? And be honest. And I think he'd be like, you know, these guys are talented, but seriously, there are guys in my home game in Texas that would destroy these guys. You know what I mean? Or something like that. I have a feeling that might come out of somebody like a Doyle Brunson. But, and like, where's Todd Brunson? Like, seriously? Yeah. Like, these guys are better than Todd Brunson? Somehow I think not.
Well, I think, to your point, what would be interesting is if they did it like the college football coaches poll, you know, where they release every coach's ranking.
Yeah.
Not because I'm, like, nosy about who it is, but I think you're right. I think you're going to see some of the older folks that voted, their list is going to skew older. And some of the really young folks, their list is going to skew way younger. So it's going to be, you know, who you played with. You know, it's kind of hard if I'm a 22-year-old player and I'm voting on this list to really be able to judge a TJ Cloutier, right? Who I probably never played with and was two decades before me, or Johnny Moss, or any of these older, really older folks, right? At the same time, if you've been out of poker for 5, 10, 20 years now, you're not going to know how good, truly good Tom Dwan is or Peter Holz. So, but I guess that's why it's good to have a variety of people voting on this. So,
yeah. And you know what this means to me? It just means we should never do these lists. I had the same feeling back when I was in college and they had the 75 years of NFL and the top 75 players. And I'm just like, give me a break. You know, there's just no way to do these lists properly. There's just no way. They're different
most
eras.
Of those are designed for discussion. So you can get those bar fights in. Hey, how can you say Roger Staubach's not the best quarterback of all time? Can't prove it, right? It's all opinion.
Jeez.
Excited about it. So I think it was a good thing to do for the 50th World Series, and obviously people can debate it for as long as they want, like we just did. So
yeah, what I liked about the list was that it reminded me that Amarillo Slim's last name was Preston.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you never remember that,
yeah,
right?
I never heard him that way. I forgot.
All right, so speaking of the World Series of Poker, the main event begins today, or has begun. Actually, it was yesterday, right?
I mean, the show is posting on the 5th. So,
oh, that's right, we're on Wednesday, so
we're
starting.
On Wednesday, so, yeah, so it's begun.
Anyhow, by the time most of you listen to this, the World Series main event will have started. Here are the highlights from the past week. The first 50 honors were doled out with Poker's Mount Rushmore. They said the most important players in World Series of Poker history being Doyle Brunson, Phil Hellmuth, Chris Moneymaker, and Daniel Negreanu. Grania was also chosen as fan favorite. Hellmuth was chosen as favorite bad boy, and Moneymaker chosen as most impressive main event winner. Phil Hugh is this year's winner of the Players' Championship, event 58, $50,000 buy-in, outlasting 73 of the best players in the world, including Josh Aurier and John Deeb at the final table. Anthony Zinno is back on winner's row, taking down event 60, the $1,500 PLO8, for his second bracelet in his 16th final World Series final table, which includes three of them this year.
Wow.
Seejin Park is the first South Korean to win an open event and the second to win an event this year, when he won event 61, the $400 Colossus. Scott Seaver is a three-time bracelet winner now after becoming the champ of event 62, the $10,000 Raz, with a final table that included Chris Ferguson, Daniel Negreanu, and David Bach. Nick Schulman picked up his third career bracelet in winning event 65, the 10K PLO8. Former world champ Joe Hashem finished third. And then finally, I lost my notes. Robert Campbell took over the Player of the Year points lead when he became the first double bracelet winner of the year after winning event 67, the 10K stud 8. He's made four final tables this year.
It happened. We knew it was going to happen. Someone was going to win too, and it's our boy, Robert Campbell.
Yep.
Pretty cool.
So I think it's interesting that the Poker's Mount Rushmore, I like how they called it that. It's good marketing, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, it's most important players in World Series of Poker history, not in poker history, which is different from the list that we were talking about.
Right.
I think it's kind of hard-pressed to come up with too many other names that you could put on there. I mean, Chris Moneymaker has to be there, right?
Yeah.
Dora Brunson has to be there. Can't imagine a World Series without Phil Hellmuth. He's got the most bracelets, right? So, Negreanu could be the only one you could really argue with, but he's just been so lights-out impressive at the World Series that again, hard pressed to find somebody else there. So.
I agree.
I guess that's it.
I was going to move on to any updates, but I felt like you wanted to say something else. It's pretty self-explanatory.
We usually go back and talk about things, but we're pretty self-explanatory this time. So move on to any updates.
All right, the Ante Up World Championship at Thunder Valley Casino Resort begins Saturday. This year's series, which runs through July 28th, features a record 30 events and nearly $1.5 million in guarantees, with two chances for players to win their way onto the cover of Ante Up. The Ante Up NorCal Classic, July 13th to 14th, and the World Championship main event, July 26th to 28th. All details are at anteupmagazine.com/world championship. And if you'd like to be one of our monthly magazine contributors and represent Ante Up in your home area, apply at anteupmagazine.com/ambassadors. We have immediate openings in the Pacific Northwest and Michigan. Find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game, you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@anteupmagazine.com. We'll have Hollywood Casino Toledo Director of Poker Elliot Check to tell you how he would have ruled. Settle in, everybody. This is a long one. Comes from Dr. Frank, our good friend Frank Toscano. He says, in a 1-2 no-limit hold'em game at a Florida card room, seats 8 and 9 are left in the hand. The river card is shown. The final board is a queen, two fours, and two other cards that don't matter. There is a bet and a call. At showdown, seat 9 tables his hand and shows queen 8 for 2 pair, queens and 4s. Seat 8 picks up his 2 cards together in his right hand and tilts them upward to show seat 9 that he has a 4 making trips. He does not show the other hole card. Seat 8 then pushes his cards face down toward the dealer. The dealer immediately slides him into the muck. The dealer never saw seat 8's hand. He announces that queens and 4s are the winner and begins to slide the pot to seat 9. Confusion ensues, and the call 4 is called. The 4 asks seat 9 if he saw the 4, and seat 9 confirms that he did see the 4. The 4 asks if seat 9 is okay with the pot going to seat 8. Seat 9 admits that his hand was beaten and that the pot should go to seat 8. Another player at the table who is not in the hand confirms that he also saw the 4, but objects that seat 8 never showed his other hole card to anyone and never tabled his hand. The 4 tells him that since he was not in the hand, that his observations or opinions were not relevant. If the 4, the dealer, and the 2 players in the hand all agreed, the pot should go to seat 8. Frank says, I understand that seat 9 should not win based on a technicality, but I think this ruling is wrong on several levels. First, for a hand to win at showdown, both hole cards should be shown. If you allow a player to win a pot by showing only one card to his opponent, this changes the game in a fundamental way. Can you imagine the confusion that would occur as players turn over one card at a time? In this situation, seat 9 could have shown just his queen for queens and 4s. Then player 8 could show a 4 for trips. Then maybe seat 9 could reveal that his other hole card was another queen for a full house. Then seat 8 could say, ha-ha, and flip over the 4 for quads. What a mess. Secondly, I believe that the observations and opinions of the player not in the hand are indeed relevant. He has an independent interest, maybe even an obligation, in maintaining the integrity of the game. How the floor rules on this hand affects hands to come. On the very next hand, see, they did it again. He showed his winning hand, both cards this time, only to the other player in the hand and threw them on the felt face down. He quickly realized what he had done. He retrieved the cards and flipped them face up so that they were tabled properly. This illustrates what I think is the floor's third error. He did not warn the player or explain to the player the necessity of proper tabling his hand. This resulted in the mistake happening again.
All right. Elliot says, I thought about giving the long answer here, but he knew Chris was wrong on the show. So, but you saved me some trouble. But he says, Frank saved him some trouble. From Robert's Rules of Poker, to win any part of a pot, a player must show all of his cards face up on the table, whether they were used in the final hand played or not. Note that the rule is a must and not should. One of the reasons for this rule is the chaos that ensues during these peekaboo contests that you describe. The back and forth is annoying to the rest of the players and the dealer and costs the casino serious revenue. But that's not the only reason. Another reason casinos use this rule is that if a player disputed the outcome when a contested pot is awarded to a different player that never correctly tabled their cards and had them read by the dealer, is that between the dealer and the surveillance footage, the casino can't prove that the pot belongs to anyone besides the player who tabled their hand correctly at showdown. We need to go into the history of the rule, too. This rule originated in the deal-your-own days of California poker, when it was not unheard of for a player to have one or more of the same card. Holding out cards from other decks and reintroducing them to win hands was a widespread cheating scheme, and showing the entire hand was an important weapon in the battle to maintain game integrity. Seeing as most games are assisted by first-generation shuffle machines that do not have card recognition or are still hand-shuffled, this rule is still pretty useful and important. Let's not forget the fact that not showing a winning hand during showdown is failure to protect your hand, one of the most important rules of public poker. The floor of the situation was trying to prevent a pot being awarded on technicality, and they deserve some credit for that. The best hand at showdown is supposed to win, and I disregard technicalities a fair amount of time, but rarely in this situation. The only table and identified hand was seat 9s, and they should get the pot. I would explain to the player in seat 8 how a hand gets tabled, the backs of the cards must be on the table, and about the responsibility to protect their hand. Also, and this is important, if a player doesn't want to show their hand at showdown, they have that right, but they forfeit any claim to the pot if they decline to show their hand. I would never feel bad about not awarding a pot to a player that failed to protect their hand and table their hand. Mm-hmm. The floor did get out of line when they told the other player's statement was not relevant. Any extra information may be useful, even if it is to be disregarded later. It appears that the floor took it personally because it seemed like this extra statement basically called the floor's ability to do their job into question.
Wow, that was the short answer.
Wow.
Oh, man. So do we need to say anything else about that? Or?
Well, no, I just think it's a little bit interesting that Elliot would have awarded the pot to seat 8. I appreciate and agree with his reasoning for it, but you know, on surface, you would think about the technicality, and there was a technicality here. But it's it seems to me that his point of view here is that this is a teaching moment for the player that refused to show his cards. So that supersedes the other two technicalities here, right? So
yeah. And,
it's the best, and he's decided to give it to the player that played properly. So. And obviously, by the fact that this player did it again on the very next hand, he must have been doing it a long time. So it would have been more helpful had a floor years ago.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We get to completing O'Malley's move today. Here comes part one. We'll see you on the other side.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are at our regular garden variety $1, $2, no limit hold'em casino cash game. It's fairly early in the night. We've been playing for about an hour. We bought in for $300 and currently have $350. The under the gun makes the table standard 4x raise to $8. He started the hand with around $500. We've only seen him play two hands so far, but he seems relatively competent. There's a caller in the MP, and we are in the cutoff with the Queen of Hearts, Queen of Clubs. Let's bump this up. We make it $30 to go. The under the gun calls, after a short hesitation, and we go to the flop with around $70 in the pot. The 9 of spades, 4 of clubs, tray of diamonds comes down. The under the gun quickly counts out a $50 bet and puts it into the pot. I like that we have position here, but I really don't want to get into a raising war and be put to a tough decision on the flop. Let's call, see the turn, and go from there. There's around 170 in the pot, and the turn is the jack of hearts. The under-the-gun counts out a $100 bet and slides it in. So, we have 270 in our stack. A call puts us down to about half of our starting stack. Are we making our move here? Is there a case for a fold? What's the move?
Really interesting sequence of actions here, I think. Our opponent didn't re-raise us pre-flop, so unless he's very crafty, I'm going to eliminate aces and kings from his most likely holdings. But since we just called the flop bet, our opponent's lead again on the turn could be an emboldened smaller pair like tens, or we just let him catch up with jacks, or maybe he flopped a set of nines and was trying to disguise his strength with an expected c-bet. I really wish we would have raised on the flop. I know O'Malley didn't want to get into a raising war, but I believe we were good on the flop and would have liked to find out then if I was wrong. Now I think we're just guessing. My guess is that we are still good, so I'm inclined to call and hope our opponent slows down the river so we can get the showdown cheaply.
I say call, but that jack does scare me a little bit. I don't think I'm going to fold, but I don't know if I'm going to raise either, so I'm just going to call and just hope that jack didn't really help him his hand at all. So, all right, here comes part two.
Hello again. We're ahead. If this player had aces or kings, he doesn't play the type of game that would simply call preflop. The flop was so safe that if he had flopped a set, there's little doubt in my mind he would have let me, the preflop aggressor, continue to show aggression. I'm supposed to have a hand here. This feels like tens, ace-king, ace-queen, or maybe various other combinations of overs. We shove. Our opponent's size flashes us the ace of clubs and mucks. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, take some time to put the action together. Even though we were facing a big bet, his actions revealed his hand. I hope to see you on the felt.
Well, I figured we were ahead, but I was nowhere near as confident as O'Malley seemed to be. I think we should have had at least a little bit of pause about that, Jack. So now the interesting discussion is whether we might have gotten more money out of our opponent had we called instead of shoved, and he didn't catch up to us on the river.
Yeah, I agree. The shove polarizes the hand for me and its outcome. Like, you're never going to get called by a worse hand there. So, I mean, you really got to know this person's going to lay it down. And like you said, it seemed like he was a lot more confident where he was than we were. So that shove to me is a scary shove. But it worked. And I don't understand the flashing of the ace of clubs. I go, what is that supposed to do? thanks for showing me a card that can never make a hand here. I mean, I just don't get it. I don't get why these guys do this thing. I think they see this stuff on TV, and they misinterpret it, what it means, and then they do it in person. I don't get it. What are you trying to tell me? You have two aces? Because then show me both aces. If you're not, then you're not going to make a flush with that. You're not making a straight with it. That you might have ace-jack? I mean, what?
Yeah, I couldn't have ace-jack. I don't think ace-jack goes away to our shove there, but I could be wrong. But
yeah.
I mean, it seems like ace-king, ace-queen. Boy. I got the best of you there with your naked ace.
Oh, man. You're brilliant showing me that ace. I'll think twice now against you.
All right, sign up with AdvancedPokerTraining.com. Hand of the week. Send your hands for situations to podcast at AndyAtMagazine.com. If you haven't won something from us in the past year, you'll get a free membership to Advanced Poker Training, the world's number one poker training site. I think we got a new submitter here. This comes from Josh Emery, and he says he was playing 1-3 at a local card room, bought in for 200 early and lost, and fired a second $200 bullet. Most of the night, I would consider the table I ended up at to be the worst in the room. The 4 to 5 players with bigger chip stacks were all decent players that weren't going to make huge mistakes. The couple weaker players at the table had bought in for the $100 minimum and were very timid to put chips in the pot. After being stuck all night, it's now 4 a.m. and I finally grinded my stack up to squiggly 650. The last couple hours, the table has made a drastic change. We've added a couple new players that bought in with deeper stacks, one of which is limp calling 50% or more of hands preflop and then playing his cards pretty much face up from there then on out. And one of the guys I thought of as decent early at this point is very drunk and has ran his squiggly 900 stack down to squiggly 400, mostly due to losing through blind aggression. Now there are two or three of us looking to get into any pot these two are in, knowing the money is there for the taking.
Wow.
All right, so I mentioned it was a situation, but there are a lot of words here. So we'll treat it like a hand of the week, and if we get to a situation point, then we'll just call it that way.
Okay.
All right, on the gun player limps. The so-called face-up player in the hijack limps, and we are in the big blind with Ace of Hearts, King of Diamonds.
Well, I mean, you know, these guys seem to be wanting to spew chips, and I'm not gonna play my hand any differently just because they're, you know, I mean, I would play it differently if I knew it would work, but in this case, I still want to take control of the hand because I'm gonna be out of position, so. I'm going to want to let them know that I've got a hand, and if they want to come along, let them come along. But I'm going to make a raise. I mean, what's it, 1-3 in the view limper? So, I don't know, 15, 20 bucks?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I always hate kind of raising out the blinds, but in this situation, I think you have to. And actually, probably with this hand in most situations, but definitely I think you have to. So, 15 sounds right to me, and that's what our hero raises to.
Yay.
He says, this is a fairly standard raise size, but definitely not one that will clear the field. I 100% expect the drunk guy in the small blind and face up in the hijack at minimum both come along. I didn't know the small blind was in.
Yeah, but, it's not. You didn't say the small blind was in. Unless you said hijack before. Yeah, so I don't know what the hell's going on here.
All right, he says the small blind does call. This is weird. And then the big blind raises the 58. Maybe we're on the button.
I think we're on the button, maybe, not the big blind. Okay.
Yeah, that's probably.
Even more reason to raise now, because now I've got position the rest of the way.
Okay, so the small blind does call. The big blind raises the 58. He says, this is one of the guys I grouped into the decent players earlier, but as the table dynamics have changed in the last couple hours, he has remained pretty tight. And hasn't gone out of his way to get into too many pots. The under the gun player folds, the hijack calls, and now it's back to us.
I know I have position and stuff, but I don't think I'm going to make it any more than this. I don't know if I want to call it, but I will call with ace-king. It's just a sickening call. You know what I mean? You're still speculating, and you got somebody showing aggression. I realize this is in the blind, but it could be somebody just trying to squeeze out a lot of people and has a decent, smaller hand. But yeah, I think that I'll probably call and then see a flop and hopefully read these players properly and take advantage of a situation where I can take the pot.
Yeah, this size raise in the big blind kind of screams like smaller pair, like I'm trying to win this pot now or make it expensive for somebody to come along. And if that's the case, obviously he has it right now, but we've got two overs. So with our chip stack here, I'm going to call and we'll see what happens going forward. But we decide just to call.
Okay.
And he says, first, because the big blind has been tight and this raise seems really strong. Second, I believe this may keep the small blind in, who may barrel off with anything. Small blind folds, though, and we are three-way to the flop, which is the ace, queen, seven with two hearts. Okay. Our villain bets 115 into the squiggly 200 pot. The hijack calls all in with his remaining 96, and it's on us now.
That's interesting. I mean, we have top pair, top kicker, and we have backdoor nut flush, right? We have the ace of hearts, I think. Ace of hearts, king of diamonds, right? So, yeah. So, you know, I think that what hand am I behind? You know, does this guy really have a set of queens? Does he really have ace queen? I mean, really, the only hand in this case, the only hand I feel like I'm losing to with this guy is pocket sevens, pocket aces, pocket queens, and ace queen. I don't feel like he has ace seven. So. Do I think those hands are likely? It's a very specific group of hands. I have top pair, top kicker. I got this guy covered, I think. And the other guy is already in, so the betting would end if I shove. I like this. I got backdoor hearts. I got top pair, top kicker. And I'm only losing to very specific hands. And if he had something like the set, I don't think he bets that much, even though I know it's a $200 pot, but I think he might make it like 60 or something to try to get some calls, you know, and not scare off the one guy who's all in with 96 bucks. You know what I mean? He might try to get some money out of the guy or get him to re-raise and then open up the betting again or something. It just feels like that bet. I mean, it's the right bet. It's if you and I were playing the hand and we were whatever he has, we would probably bet a little around half the pot. So maybe a little more, maybe 2/3. But even so, I just feel like we're ahead. I don't know why. I just don't feel like we could have the same hand. But this guy could have something like kings. He could have ace-jack. The bet was the right bet. It's a decent bet. It's not, you know, it should be like one, maybe 140 or so. I don't know. But in this case, it feels like it's a decent bet. So he's not too afraid of that ace. But I don't know. I don't know. It feels like we have the same hand. But I don't know. I like the hearts. I don't know if I want to call, though. Because then if a blank comes and he shoves, then what do I do? You know? I don't know. I think I raise. I think I raise. I think because I got that dead money in there. I think I shove. And the only way I'm losing is if this guy has a set. And even then, I still have backdoor hearts. If he has ace-queen, I still have a king. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. If he has a set of sevens, then we need the hearts that don't pair the board or something. But I just don't feel like he's got a set of sevens. Maybe the case ace came out somehow, or he flopped a set of queens. But I really feel like there's something about that bet that doesn't feel like he's hit that hand. I don't know what it is, but I'm gonna shove.
I'm gonna shove. Wow.
Yeah, I'm gonna shove.
Yeah, I guess we when we were down to I don't know we when are we with our stack? Yeah.
You said that he had worked it back up to
650.
Yeah, 650.
653. Yeah. So, Yeah, I don't know about the shove. I do like the raise, though. I mean, I think, the villain very well could have pocket kings here. You know, kings, you still try to bet that out and see if you can clear the field. So we got that crushed. Pocket aces are less likely because we have one of them. The pocket queens are what I'm most worried about. And I did mention preflop that bigger raise is for a to protect a smaller pair. So those sevens are possible as well, too. I don't think the ace-queen is out there. Ace-queen, that seems like a big raise for an ace-queen preflop, especially against a button raise. But I think I'd want to find out now where we are right now.
Yeah, I mean, what do you do then, though? Usually when you raise 3x what they're raising. Yeah, that's four.
Probably that's 300, and then, yeah, so.
That's 345. You don't have that much left, so you're shoving. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I don't want to just call and let this guy dictate.
I don't know. I mean, I could raise to 300 here and still have half my stack left.
Well, there's 58 in there.
What if you're shoving, you're wrong here now? You know, of course, I don't know what the villain has here, right? That might be helpful.
Plus
okay, he has 500 left.
Yeah, so if you're going to make it 300, he's only got 200 left. He's either going to shove on you anyway, or on the turn, he's shoving anyway. So, I mean, you might as well make him make the decision rather than you have to make two decisions.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, if he only has 325 left, which is what it sounds like he has, then yeah, because that's going to be my raise anyhow.
Right, right.
So
I'm shoving.
All right. Yeah, you're right. All right.
Yay, let's shove.
The shove seems scarier because it's so much, but it doesn't really matter. Yeah, right. So, okay. All right. Well, our hero decides to call. And the turn is an offsuit deuce. So that board now is ace, queen, seven, deuce with two hearts still. And the villain jams his remaining squiggly 325 into the squiggly 500 pot. And back to us.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's why I wanted to avoid this, but I'm still, I think I'm calling.
Right, I mean, if we were going to put 325 in before, the deuce doesn't mean anything, right?
Well, we were going to, but he wasn't going to. So I mean,
right,
now,
yeah. But I'm like, you know, you're still risking the same amount. You're right. It's much better for us to have put it in and put him to the test than the other way around. But
right.
We still weren't going to put that in, right? So
yeah, I mean,
still
this way,
be doing this with any of those hands that we're talking about, including kings. So.
Well, this way you have the chance of actually winning his 325, whereas before he might have just folded and you only won his 115. Now you have a chance to win it, but you got to hope that your hand's better. You know, at this point, you're thinking, oh, am I really just calling to win a bluff? Because now I don't have the hearts anymore. You know, you had the hearts last flop chance, but now you can't get the flush. So, you know, there was outs before that you thought you could get if you ran into trouble. Now you have one card to come if you're in trouble, and you might be drawn dead. So there is some thinking now. We can't compound our mistakes either. Our mistake, I think, earlier was not putting this guy to the test on the flop. Now he's put us to the test, and we have one card to come. I really don't like to put all my money in with less than two pair. You know what I mean? I one pair, top pair, top kicker is okay if I'm going to have a bunch of money left over or it's a tournament. But in this case, it's like, ugh. Do I really want to throw off 325 here with one pair and one card to come? Before there were outs, there was some sort of, hey, I'm going to sort of still navigate this.
That's
now
true. We don't have the hard possibility now, right?
Yeah, so now it's like, okay, if I'm wrong, I could be drawn dead. And if I'm not drawn dead, I have one card to help me to come, you know. So it's still a thinker. I feel like, though, I don't know what it is. I just feel like this guy's got something like the same hand as us or ace jack or ace ten.
The same hand. Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
But I don't know if I want to let this hand go. I don't know. A lot of times I'd fold this hand, but I wouldn't have called either. If I was convinced this guy had me beat last street, there's no reason to be in the hand. So why did the deuce help him? Right? So there's no way. Why am I going to call off 115 only to fold to a offsuit deuce the next hand, next card? You know what I mean? I'm going to either raise last street or I'm going to fold last street. And I'm never going to fold with ace-king, so why not raise? And so I guess I'm talking myself into a call here. That deuce couldn't have helped him.
No.
So it's either we're ahead or we're behind. That's how it goes. Or as, you know. Never mind, I'm not going to say it. But anyway, I think I could talk myself into a call here, believe it or not. I don't know why. A lot of times in the past, I would have folded this, and you could...
Yeah, I'm not going to fault somebody for folding, but I think call is the right play here. And again, we don't have as much information as we hoped for. We should have, you know, raised on the flop, but we've had a good day at the office. I'm willing to put some of the bolts that we've accumulated into this pot to win more, so...
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be down... Again, though, because we only earned our first 200 bullet back to get it up to 500 or 600. So when we lose, if we lose this hand, right, it's 325 plus the 115, so it's 400. So we're going to be back down to down 200 and have $200 left or whatever. So yeah, it's going to suck, but you know, it's 4 a.m., so I don't think we're playing much longer. That's going to suck. But that doesn't really come into my mind. They're tools of the trade. I'm not thinking like that. I'm thinking like this is the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. And in this case, I agree with the call, with a call.
All right. Our hero says, go into the tank for quite a while, eliminate ace from his holdings because the hijack has to have an ace in his hand to have called the flop bet. That gives him six combos of ace-king that I chop with. We really shove this as a value bet, though. It seems like suicide. So for value, I can put him on only one of the nine combos, ace-queen and queen-queen. And what about bluffs? I hold the ace of hearts, so he can't have ace jack of hearts, ace ten of hearts, and I don't see him three betting with any weaker hands. King of hearts, jack of spades could make that shove maybe, but again, I don't see that in his three betting range. I eventually decide villain must have ace queen or queen queen, and lay down my hand.
Yeah, if he had a set though, why is he shoving on you? If he has top two or a set, he's not afraid of you drawing out on him anymore. I mean, the hearts maybe. But, I mean, I think he makes a more of a value bet there than shoving and scaring you. Why would he do that with ace-queen or queen-queen? I mean, queen-queen, if you shove there, you really got to think we're drawing the hearts. And I can see that because we just called the bet.
But chip stack's kind of tough here, right? So it's $500 pot. I mean, the proper bet is at least 250, if not 300. And so you have 325. I mean, are you going to leave 25 bucks to 75 bucks behind?
Yeah, I guess.
You know, it is a little bit too big of a bet, but just with my chip stack, I'm going to look down and I'm like, you know, this doesn't make any sense. I might as well shove. And at that point, again, the over bet, usually you could pick up some people that think that you're betting big for with a weaker hand, too. So, you know, there's a chance you're going to get paid off on it as well, too. So, I think this is a bet that you would make with any winning hand here, I think. So.
If you have a stranglehold on the hand, though, are you really thinking shove 325, or are you thinking I want to get more money out of this guy? Make the same bet I just made, make it like 130 or 150.
You know, that's the only other bet you could probably make is the same bet 115. I mean, anything else is kind of. I mean, you're not going to bump it up to 150. Whoa, you know. And
I just bet half my stack is fine.
If you double it, it's the rest of your stack. So, I mean, that's really the only way you can get away with not shoving there, I think. So,
I like a bet of 150 there if I have. Queen set of queens or ace queen. I don't like shoving because the whole thing of shoving is a scare tactic too. You know, there's a lot of times people hear shove or they see all your chips go in the middle and they automatically shut down. They get nervous regardless of thinking of how much money it is. There's something that is added pressure to that when you shove. It just seems like to me that you know he could have made it if he had a set or top two. He's not shoving. I just think he would try to find a number that we have to call, you know? I don't know. And well, if you're drawing, a number that makes it a mistake to call. You know, I don't know. It just seems weird, that bet. I feel like we're still ahead and I'm calling.
All right. The river's a brick. Both players turn over ace-jack to chop up my 170, he says. And they missed out on an $1,100 pot.
Wow. Both players have ace-jack and the case ace comes out. That's crazy.
He says the villain later says he knew he was behind and that shoving was the only way he could win. He says, I don't believe that. Not many people are turning top pair into a bluff without some sort of redraw to go with it. Also, if he knew he was behind, there were far more combos of the ace-queen and queen-queen that a bluff would not have worked on compared to my ace-king. Now, I don't know about that. I'm like, you know, he's in a spot there, right? I think he's right. It's the only way he could win. That doesn't mean he will win, right?
Right.
Doesn't mean that we have a better hand. We're going to call and beat him. But, you know, I mean, what's he going to do? Check there and then hope we check behind with the better hand? That's not going to happen. So, I mean, back to your point, you know, it was a big bet, right? So, I mean, that is the only way you're going to win. It's a tough spot to be in. And it ended up working for him. But, you know, that's what you have to do with that spot. I'm like, otherwise you put almost all your chips in there and you're going to wave the white flag and get pushed off of it. So,
yeah, I just feel like that bet, and that bet was exactly what we thought it was. The guy said, you know, I got myself into this, and the only way I'm going to get myself out is to lose a ton or to win a ton. So, and he shoved with it. Like I said, if I'm in that place, and I think you too, I don't think you shove with that. I think unless you're convinced this guy's trying to draw, but even then he's only got one card to go. You know, I still think that we make it like 150. I really do. And then we're showing the guy that we've bet half our stack, and that you know the other half's going in on the river. That's enough to turn somebody away too if they're not confident in their hand. Because you know we're not folding again on the river for that amount of money, so you know it's probably going in. And then you're getting value if the guy does have something like ace-10. So I just feel like that shove really was to intimidate, and it worked. It really worked. I can't believe that. That's terrible. You're going to win a huge pot.
Yeah, I did say two spots I think about now are, should I have four bet pre instead of trying to keep the small blind in? Said this would have given me control of the hand. I would have bet the flop and certainly been called by both. Turn would have much more likely been checked to me and blocking the only likely flush draws, I would have checked it back. Then on the river, if checked to me, I could easily bet for value, or if the villain decides to lead out then, I think the call would have been much easier with me showing weakness on the turn. And second, should I have re-raised in the flop? If villain was truly value betting, he may have still jammed here, but then I think I would have had to call off since I would be getting better pot odds and having the backdoor flush outs too.
Yeah, I think we talked about that. We covered that. I agree with that. That's what you probably should have done. That would have changed it. And I guess the four bet, I'm not a big four better in a cash game with ace king off. You know, if I made a big raise and then a guy in a blind says, you know what, I'm re-raising you, then, you know, I'm going to put him on a decent hand there, and I still only have what Gambit loves to call a drawing hand. But in this case, yeah, I don't agree with the four bet preflop. I just don't. I don't care about the small blind staying in or not. That's just the right thing to do. I was thinking about folding actually, and not even calling. So, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Josh, for sending it in, and I hope you enjoy your gift. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Lowe.
We'll see you at the table.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@antiupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@antiupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.